Robin Wall Kimmerer is a botanist who blends Western science with more traditional ways of knowing. She describes her field experiments as kind of like interviewing a plant. She believes nature is full of living beings, not just the plants and animals, but also the rocks and the wind. Kimmerer is both a PhD biologist and a member of the Potawatomi Nation, and she's trying to reconcile Western science with the wisdom of her Potawatomi elders. It's a process she spells out in her book, Braiding Sweetgrass. She stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
Robin, you've said that if you're going to be native to a place, you have to learn to speak its language. So what does it mean to learn to speak the language of, let's say, a forest, one of the places you study?
I think one of the most important ways to become part of your place is to know the names of your neighbors, just like in a human neighborhood. So to take the time to learn the names of plants, it's an exercise in paying attention. And just to know that, like in the winter, the texture of the different barks, in the summer, the taste of the different berries, to really engage all of your senses. And it helps you feel part of a place as well.
What can the taste of a berry tell you about the plant?
Well, the taste of a berry can tell you so much about the plant. It can tell you who eats it, the way the seeds are placed. You know, turtles eat one kind of berry, birds eat another kind of berry. And so the taste of them gives you kind of an insight into the web of their relationships.
Now, part of your heritage is you're a member of the Potawatomi Nation, and I know there's a tradition among Potawatomi elders of trees talking to each other. What does that mean?
Well, from a traditional perspective, our teachings are that there was a time in the world when the trees, the birds, the animals, and the humans all spoke the same language, that we could all communicate with one another and did so freely, but that we humans have forgotten how to do that. There's also a scientific way of knowing, and this is a place where scientific and traditional knowledge converge, actually, and the modern science of chemical ecology tells us the trees are talking to each other.
What are they saying to each other?
Oh, in our limited vocabulary that scientists have been able to decipher so far, they're sending warnings to each other. It's well-established science about how a tree that's under attack from a certain insect will send a chemical signal off through the wind to the other trees in the neighborhood that says, uh-oh, gypsy moths are coming, better turn on your defenses. They even have chemical signals that invite other beings to come visit them as pollinators, for example.
Now, you have an unusual background. I mean, you are not only a distinguished scientist and environmental biologist, but you are steeped in native traditions, particularly of the Potawatomi Nation. And can you tell me a little bit about your background?
Sure. I grew up in the woods of upstate New York, far from our Potawatomi people, whose homelands are here in the Midwest, in the upper Midwest. And I grew up, in a sense, separated from the real materiality of traditional culture by way of the federal policies of removal and assimilation, in that my grandfather was one of those kids who was taken from his family, put on a train, and sent back east to Carlisle Indian School.
How old was he when that happened?
He was only 9 years old. Imagine that. And so that whole intentional process of deculturating a people. He was a victim of that. And I remember as a kid always asking my dad things about our language, things about practices. And he'd have to say, I'm sorry, sweetie, I don't know. That was all left on the doorstep of the Carlisle Indian School. And even as a little kid, I thought, if they could have a school that would take all that away from you, have you unlearn who you were, there ought to be a way that you can learn that again. And that really became a mission for me.
And you've actually gone back to study the Potawatomi language, right?
Well, study is a kind word. I'm definitely an amateur. I've taken advantage of the language revitalization programs that many of the Potawatomi communities have sponsored.
So what has struck you about learning this language, what you have learned so far?
One of the things is it's very difficult language, not only because the sounds are different, but it turns out that Potawatomi language is verb-based. language. In English, I think the number is like 70% of our words are nouns, whereas in Potawatomi, 70% of the words are verbs.
Really?
But it was in that difficulty that, for me, I discovered the thing that I love best about the language is the philosophy that underlies it. What we have are two cases of animate and inanimate verbs. You listen to an airplane with a different verb than you listen to a blue jay, because one is alive and one is not. And all the verbs are that way. There's a particular grammar for animacy. Hmm. And that makes speaking and learning the language, for me, very difficult, but also really beautiful. Because what it means is that it's the acknowledgement that the world is alive, that all those plants and animals and rocks and water that I grew up with, having that sense of their vitality and their animacy, our language recognizes that.
So what would be some examples of verbs that are used in the Potawatomi language that, you know, in English, we would just have a noun to describe that thing?
The verb for a bay, that little inlet in a lake, that isn't a noun. It is the verb to be a bay. And at first I really scoffed at that, thinking, how is that possible? A body of water is not a verb. Oh, yes, it is, if that water is alive, if that water has agency, if that water can choose to be a bay now and a waterfall later. So that was just an electric moment for me of realizing that what this difficulty in the language is doing is actually acknowledging the life of the living world and speaking of it in that beautiful way.
I mean, this is so fascinating, because what you're talking about is you're talking about a different worldview.
Yes.
That words and the structure of the language conveys another way of seeing the world.
Absolutely. And the example that is for me so powerful is that when we think of that bay, or we think of the loon that's swimming in that bay, if you picture that loon for a second, in English, how do we speak of that bird? We have to say, I see it. It is diving for fish. It is calling before the rain. And we call it it. And it is the same word that we use for trucks and pencils, right? We use it for objects. And so in English, we're imprisoned in a worldview that objectifies nature, that objectifies and can therefore open the doors to exploitation of nature.
Now, my understanding of animistic traditions is that all of nature is considered alive. I mean, it's not just people, it's not just plants and animals, it's rocks, it's wind. How seriously do you take that view? I mean, you're a trained scientist.
I am a trained scientist. And, you know, in Biology 101, when we learn what does it mean to be alive, we also learn the categories, as you say, of what is alive. And we don't put rocks and waters and mountains in those categories. So we say that they're inert. We say that they're natural resources, if you will. But they have a different kind of life within them, a life that operates at a different pace, with different scales and structures of organization. And so as a scientist, I try to be very careful to say that science is really a set of tools. It's a lens to look at the world. It's a lens. And if we look at rocks through the scientific lens and definition, scientific definition of what it means to be alive, they don't fit. But there's another lens in a different worldview.
So tell me, how are rocks alive?
Think about the way in which a boulder over time becomes sand. That is a transformation. Oftentimes in science, we adopt the scientific way of knowing as a bit of an intellectual monoculture, as if that's the only way to understand the world. And when we encounter something that doesn't fit that, we call it, oh, it's woo-woo, it's supernatural, and it doesn't fit science, and therefore it can't be real. If we can't measure it, it can't be real. Well, we may not be able to measure it, but that may just be because we haven't defined it properly and we don't have the right tools. If we think it doesn't exist, we don't have the tools to measure it.
Well, I'm sure that one of the reasons why science has tried to sort of turn all these pieces of nature into its is they want to get rid of all that spiritual stuff. And it would seem to fly in the face of what I understand of various animist traditions, which is, I mean, a lot of these parts of nature are connected to spirit beings in some way.
Yes. And in indigenous ways of knowing, we think about humans as having at least four capacities for knowing the world. One of them is intellectual. One of them is mental, right? One of them is physical. But that we also have spiritual and emotional ways of knowing the world. Whereas the scientific method, part of the power of the scientific method, is that it uses only one of those four gifts. Well, maybe two, right? The intellect and the physical ability to sense and measure. But emotion and spirit we set aside. You know, Cartesian dualism. We don't talk about that. We only talk about the mechanism, about the rational perspective. And I honor that because a lot of the way that science has made advancements in understanding mechanism comes through that isolation. But science has absolutely no capacity to explore the role of spirit and emotion in the workings of the world. Science is really, really good at answering what I think of as true-false questions. That's what hypotheses are, right? They're true-false questions. And then you amass all those little bits into our understanding. And that's a fine way of knowing. But it isn't the only way of knowing.
Do you have experiences that we might call, I don't know, spiritual or mystical when you're out in the woods, out in nature, encountering other species, non-human species? Is that transformative for you at times?
I would say that it's no longer transformative, and that I've turned a corner to expect that. That when I'm in the woods, I expect that I am surrounded by a community of other beings who know I'm there, and I know they're there, and we're in conversation with one another. It puts me in mind of one of those favorite anthropology stories of some anthropologist allegedly saying to a native person, a young woman, said, "Well, do you ever go alone into the woods?" And she couldn't answer that question. And he writes in his journals how, well, she must be really quite dim if she couldn't answer the question of, do you go alone in the woods? And finally, in conversation, she revealed that that was really an oxymoron. You couldn't be alone in the woods because all of those other beings are there with you.
Has your understanding of some of these indigenous traditions that you've been describing, has it made you a better scientist?
Absolutely. I think that it helps me pay attention more to things that I have not set out to measure. When I go into the field, when I'm doing an experiment, I think about it as a kind of an interview. Because we no longer speak the language of these other beings, I'm going to do an experiment that allows that being to answer my questions in a way that I can understand, you know. Dandelions, how do you feel about nitrate? I can't ask them that, but I'm going to give them different amounts of nitrate and see what they say. And they say through their biomass, through their rate of photosynthesis, whatever. To me, that's an interview with someone who doesn't speak your language. So somehow being able to, again, cross that boundary from scientist to plant, and that sounds really arrogant, like you could do that. But in some way, you can, from a really humble perspective of saying, I want to try to imagine what it's like to experience this world as the plant does.
To try to sort of take on some plant consciousness.
Yes, yeah. To say, what matters to you, plant? I think I know what matters to you as a scientist, but why don't you tell me? So that other kind of listening is, I think, makes me a better scientist.
Thank you. This has been great.
Thanks, Steve.
Robin Wall Kimmerer with Steve Paulson. Robin's a botanist at the State University of New York at Syracuse, and she's the author of Braiding Sweetgrass.